Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Why can pain stick around for months, even years? And what's actually keeping it alive in your body? That's the question my guest today has dedicated his career to answering. Dr. Theodore Price is a neuroscientist and Ashbel Smith Professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, where he also serves as a director of the Center for Advanced Pain Studies. His research focuses on the molecular mechanisms that cause chronic pain, with the goal of developing new and better treatments. He has published over 200 scientific studies, been continuously funded by the U.S. government's top medical research agency, and co-funded several biotech companies, including E-Therapeutics, to bring those discoveries into real-world treatments. And today, we'll unpack the science of pain. I am so excited to be here and have this conversation with you.
Thank you so much.
But before we get into the science, I would love to know, why pain and what got you interested in studying pain?
It was really kind of an accident. I did my undergraduate studies in physics initially, and then discovered that I wasn't actually that great at physics and had an advisor who suggested I should try neuroscience. So I tried neuroscience. I actually took a lab course for my first course. And I absolutely loved it. I was hooked almost immediately and decided I wanted to be a neuroscientist for my career, and then went to go do a PhD in a program that had a major strength in neurological disorders and developing new drugs to treat neurological disorders. And the thing that I thought I was going to do was to work on depression. I just happened to do a rotation with a scientist named Ken Hargreaves and Chris Flores. They ran their labs together. That was absolutely fantastic, and got into the pain field because I was working in their labs. And even when I was doing my PhD, I didn't really think I would spend my career in the pain field. I worked on cannabinoid pharmacology when I was doing my PhD, and I thought maybe I would go into the cannabinoid pharmacology area. It was really when I was making the choice of where to do a postdoc that I decided to stay in the pain area, and I've been very glad that I made that decision. I think that the ultimate reason I decided to do it is because I was interested in neuroplasticity. That's what got me interested in neuroscience to begin with. And I think what I learned over the years is that pain is an amazing opportunity to study and understand neuroplasticity. And at the same time, take what you're learning and hopefully translate it into therapeutics that will really help people who deal with chronic pain disorders.
It's very interesting you said depression. Do you think that depression has any effect on chronic pain?
That's a very good question. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that one for sure. They are extremely what we call comorbid conditions. So they co-occur in many people. And I think there are ideas on both sides of the fence that pre-existing depression can cause people to develop chronic pain. But I think the best evidence is that people with chronic pain that is left untreated over a long period of time often develop depression. So it's probably true that it can go both ways in some number of individuals, but the best evidence, as far as I'm concerned, is that people who have chronic pain, if it's untreated, often develop depression because of the chronic pain. Now, that may happen because the chronic pain changes the brain at the kind of sub-anatomic level and at the level of neurochemistry that actually drives that depression to occur, which is an interesting thing to study in and of itself.
Can we talk about that a little bit more in depth? So
sure.
How does chronic pain, you mentioned that chronic pain has an effect, or what were you saying? Sorry.
Yeah, so many studies, both preclinical animal studies and also human neuroimaging studies, have demonstrated that the presence of chronic pain literally changes the brain. So there are studies that have been done in animals where people like myself have shown that there is neuroplasticity within structures that you don't normally think of as being involved in pain in the brain, for instance, in the prefrontal cortex. I think that a lot of that work suggests that the presence of persistent pain, in particular neuropathic pain, creates changes in the prefrontal cortex that ultimately affects your ability to pay attention to in cognitive tasks. So I think that that is important to recognize. And then neuroimaging studies have shown that areas of the brain show thinning in people who have chronic pain, and that thinning is not permanent. So there have been some studies, for instance, by Dave Semenowicz, who is a leading researcher in this area. They've done interventions in people, so like they'll study them longitudinally, show that there's a difference in their brain structure, and then they give an intervention that can be effective in some of the patients, and then in others it might not be effective, and they show that in the patients where they had good efficacy, that the brain changes are actually reversed. So it's not like it's a neurodegenerative change that happens within the brain, which would be really scary if that was true. But it seems to be an active process that's driven by the ongoing pain state. And if you can figure out a way to treat it, it can be reversed relatively rapidly, actually.
Is it because the brain is actually focusing on the pain?
I think it's because the peripheral nervous system is activated all the time in people who have chronic pain, right? So there's essentially this electrical signal that's coming from the periphery, so out at the site where you had an injury that may have healed, but the sensory neurons that innervate the injury, like the low back, are still activated. They're sending the signal all the time, and that persistent kind of alarm bell going off, so it's not an actual alarm bell going off in the brain, but you know, the signal that's coming into the brain all the time causes this neuronal plasticity, and it's an activity, what we call an activity dependent form of neuronal plasticity. So as long as that signal continues to go, the change in the brain is maintained. But when you take away the signal, in this case with an effective treatment, like in many of these studies they've used a lidocaine patch, so something relatively simple, but something that a lot of people don't ever try. And it was effective in a subset of patients, and in those subset of patients, the change in the brain goes away.
It's very interesting. So people, clinical guidelines recommend for people with chronic low back pain, physical activity, you know, and usually after exercising, you do feel better and less in pain, usually. Is it because we are pain gating, or why do you think that is?
So there's a lot of evidence.
What happens in the brain when we exercise?
But there's a lot of evidence that exercise engages what we call the pain descending modulatory circuits. So these are circuits that originate in the midbrain and the brainstem, mostly from what's called the periaqueductal gray and the rostroventromedial medulla. And what happens when you engage those centers, it sends signals back down, neuronal signals back down into the spinal cord. And it stops the pain signals as they enter the spinal cord. So the way that the peripheral nervous system to the spinal cord signaling works is that you have peripheral neurons that innervate your entire body. They get activated and they send a signal to what's called a second order neuron in the spinal cord. That second order neuron is the gate, so to speak, that allows the pain signal to go on up to the brain. So the brain has this really funny arrangement of what we call endogenous analgesia. And you would think that the way this would work is that the brain stem or the midbrain or wherever this originates would send a signal up to the cortex and it would change your perception of pain there. But the fact is that the pain signals distribute in many different parts of your brain, and we don't actually know exactly where the pain percepts originates from. And in fact, it probably originates from integrating information in multiple cortical regions. So instead, the way this has evolved is that the brain's endogenous analgesia center actually sends a signal back down to the spinal cord and stops that peripheral signal from coming up to the brain in the first place by blocking it at the level of the spinal cord. So if you think about it logically and know how the neuroanatomy works, it actually makes a ton of sense that it would work that way. But if you don't understand the neuroanatomy, I think it's kind of counterintuitive that a system would work in such a way. And if you think about endogenous opioids, and many people have heard of the endogenous opioid system, that's essentially how it works, is that you can control it from prefrontal cortex, and part of exercising is probably, you know, the movement and everything changes the way that your brain is acting on these circuits, and you activate this endogenous analgesia more effectively, and exercise can unquestionably decrease pain at the time that you're doing the exercise. The problem is that it can also cause you to have delayed onset muscle soreness and other things that can be misinterpreted as damage to your tissues and make it very hard to sustain exercise. And then there can also be acute pain that happens during exercise that is kind of unrelated to the exercise, but can be interpreted as that alarm bell going off again that can make exercise difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever had back pain?
Yeah. So I started having back pain playing football when I was in junior high. And then it got worse when I was in high school. And I basically struggled with it for about 15 years until I was a postdoc in my early 30s. And then I had a disc essentially explode on me and had really intense neuropathic pain from that. I had a central disc herniation. So most discs, when they herniate, that kind of goes out, right? My disc actually went inside the spinal canal, so it created severe neuropathic pain, and it also paralyzed my left leg for a period of time. So it was quite an experience. I had surgery about a month after the acute injury, and was just extremely lucky to have a great outcome. I mostly have motor recovery, and I don't have ongoing neuropathic pain most of the time. But I can definitely sympathize with people that have ongoing back pain, because I had it for a long time and just got very lucky to have an extraordinarily good outcome from a surgery.
That's great. Great to hear that.
Yeah, so, I'm lucky.
Yeah,
it's good. And I know I'm lucky.
Yeah. So is there... So we have different, well, we have chronic pain, we have acute pain. Mm-hmm. So if I burn my finger on the stove, is that the same pain when if someone is like having a chronic pain for 10 years? Is that exactly the same pain?
Probably not. Acute pain is a really important protective mechanism. And we know that because there are individuals who have genetic mutations where they don't feel pain at all. This is called congenital insensitivity to pain. So there's a couple of different genes that have been discovered that can cause this, and individuals that have that usually have relatively short lifespans, and the reason for that is because they sustain many, many injuries that often cause them to have severe infections that can ultimately kill them. Mm. So we know that acute pain plays this extraordinarily important survival role, and we've all had the experience where we're doing something that we shouldn't be doing, like walking on a hot sidewalk in the Texas heat, and we're immediately told not to do that because you feel the burning, and if you didn't stop doing it, the skin on your feet would literally burn. So that's not the same situation as chronic pain. So chronic pain usually involves kind of lower level activation of the peripheral nervous system. There's plasticity in the peripheral nervous system. There's plasticity in the central nervous system that can cause that lower level activity to be perceived as high level activity because of a process that we call central sensitization. And it really is kind of a transformation of this alarm bell into a low level alarm bell that starts to feel like a full level alarm bell all the time. But it's an adaptive process, I think, that isn't really telling you that there's some active injury. In most cases,
want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. G-O-F-U-N-D-M-E GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Is that there really isn't some active injury that you need to attend to, even though that's certainly what it feels like. So I think that's important to recognize and also helpful to think about in terms of, you know, how you can potentially overcome it through a mix of therapeutics and things like physical therapy.
So pain is like, example, like a smoke alarm, right? So it can go off even if there is no fire, right? And what are the things that can contribute to that? Like, you know.
So my view from the work that I've done, the work that many other, mostly neuroscientists that work on this problem have done, is that injuries, and by injuries, I mean injuries that cause some tissue damage and usually also some damage to peripheral nerves, change the physiology of peripheral nerves so that they go from being quiet most of the time, mm-hmm. and by quiet I mean that they're not generating these electrical signals, which we call action potentials, to being in a situation where they're spontaneously or ectopically, we use those words kind of interchangeably, producing these action potentials. And that spontaneous activity causes this kind of electrical and shooting pain and also these like sharp pains that many people have when they do things like have a bad back and bend over to lift something off the floor, and suddenly, you know, it's this severe pain where there's really no way in most instances that you could have injured yourself by doing something so terribly mm-hmm. simple, at least mm-hmm. injured yourself severely. So why these seemingly kind of strange triggers can cause this to happen, I don't think anybody understands how the triggers are linked to that. The reason is that the peripheral nervous system, and to some extent the central nervous system, but I think the peripheral nervous system is the most important part of this, is just very sensitized. It responds to things that it wouldn't normally respond to. And what we know now is that even after an injury, it's very difficult for the peripheral nervous system to go back to the way it was before. So you would think, you know, when the injury resolves, the peripheral nervous system would just go back to its previous state. But we know now that that's really not what happens. It has a tendency to stay in this hyperactive, sensitized state for a very, very long period of time.
Mental health, sleep, you know, make you feel like, you know, you're kind of like more sensitized, or can lower that, you know, your pain threshold?
Sleep, there's no question about it. I mean, disrupted sleep is, well, it's bad for you in many, many different ways. But there have been many studies now that show that disrupted sleep is linked to worse pain outcomes. Mm-hmm. We also, of course, know that chronic pain can disrupt sleep. So there's a vicious cycle between the two. I think that that's an important area for people if they're looking to find ways to get healthier when they have chronic pain. Paying attention to what you can do to improve sleep can really have a big impact. I think, unfortunately, this is one of these things that's kind of overlooked a lot of times, but that there probably should be much more attention put to that. And there's quite a bit of evidence, mostly emerging from preclinical studies, and by preclinical, I mostly mean studies that have been done in animals, that disrupted sleep can change the physiology of peripheral nerves.
Wow. And how can it change that?
Well, that's not understood so well now. It's possible that there are changes in the immune system and that the immune system interacting with the nerves causes that to happen. Another possibility is that it changes these descending modulatory circuits coming from the midbrain and the brainstem, mm-hmm. and those are ultimately affecting the peripheral nervous system because they do communicate with the peripheral nervous system through these nerve endings that come into the spinal cord. And I think right now we just don't know which of those is true or if both of them are true. However, don't really need to know what the causes are necessarily because there are interventions that can be done to improve sleep quality. So, you know, for people that are really struggling with chronic pain and have these sleep problems, I think it's a really good idea to try to get help for the sleep problems because it's likely that that will improve quality of life.
Yeah, they usually have sleep problems because they can't sleep because of the pain. So for someone who is not a scientist, how do you explain pain?
Well, I explain it like an alarm system because that's mm-hmm. how I kind of view it. I mean, again, like I said, we know that there are these genetic mutations where the system is extraordinarily important for your survival, and that's really what it does. And it's amazing how the pain system wires up to your brain. So if you think about your visual system or your hearing system, it really goes from your ears or from your eyes to a very specific place in your brain. The light touch system does the same thing. It comes from the same area, the dorsal root ganglia and the trigeminal ganglia, into the spinal cord, and then straight up to the brain, and basically just goes to one place, whereas the pain system distributes itself all over your brain. So it comes up from the spinal cord, it goes into the limbic system, which is the amygdala and other structures like that. It goes to the anterior cingulate cortex. It goes to the primary sensory cortex. It just essentially wires up to all of your major systems to ring an alarm to say, you know, stop whatever you're doing and pay attention to this pain, because it's important for you to get away from whatever it is that's hurting you. So it's a wonderful thing to get us to survive all kinds of nasty things that can happen to us in the world, but it's also a terrible thing for people who have had an injury and then have this sensitization that occurs in the nervous system and doesn't fix itself. Also, you know, I keep saying have an injury. It's not always an injury that causes people to have this. So neuropathies can occur because of a metabolic disease like diabetes. They can occur because of chemotherapeutic treatments that people might be having for cancer. They can also occur for no apparent reason. There are many people who have what's called idiopathic neuropathy, and that simply means that we don't know what it is. It certainly doesn't mean it's not real. And then there are also neuropathies that can be caused by autoimmune diseases. And, you know, I think what we're learning now is that more of these so-called idiopathic neuropathies are actually driven by autoimmune diseases. And those can affect all the nervous system in many different ways. Sometimes it manifests as low back pain, for instance.
Yeah. So sometimes pain is good, right? Because it protects.
Yes. 100%.
Not when you have chronic back pain.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about you can have pain without an injury as well, right? Why can someone still have back pain for years after the body has healed?
So I think that that's another case of neuronal plasticity, and it can happen in a number of ways. One of the things that we're learning about now is how injuries to tissues or just underlying disease, so it can be like joint degeneration. And it's important to remember your vertebrae are joints, right? So you have the bones, which make up the vertebrae, and then you have the discs in between, and they move all the time. They're joints, just like your knees and your hips. And as we age, all of our joints degenerate to some extent. So one of the things that we're learning, mostly from studies that we're doing on tissues that are taken during biopsies, like synovial biopsies, or removed during lumbar disc fusion surgeries, is that the innervation of these structures can change after injury. So most of the time in your discs, for instance, just the outside of the annulus fibrosus is innervated, but the inside of the annulus fibrosus, which is the outside part of the disc, and then the inside, the nucleus pulposus, is not innervated at all. So you have no nerve endings there. But if you take somebody who has lumbar disc degeneration and you look at their discs, what you can see is that the innervation has totally changed. So you have a lot of sprouting of fibers, which are mostly nociceptive fibers. On the outside of the disc, you have some that are going into the annulus fibrosus, and you even have some nerve fibers that seem to go into the nucleus pulposus. So normally those areas don't have any nerve fibers, and they produce lots of things like cytokines that can activate these nerve fibers and inflammatory mediators that, you know, they normally stay encapsulated within the disc. So I think that those kind of structural changes are an unappreciated way that people become sensitized. And again, if you just think about how the neuroanatomy has changed, it becomes kind of clear why this can be so painful, because now you have mechanical activation of these fibers from all kinds of movements that normally you didn't even have any fibers there, right? So they wouldn't have been activated in the first place. So it's just a total fundamental change. And I think an important thing to try to figure out is how to reverse that, because I'm pretty convinced that that's a major part of the pathology. And it's also a major part of the reason why what used to be very simple or mundane movements for somebody can suddenly become extremely painful. It can also cause a situation where it becomes very hard for people to be able to do exercises and things like that, which would otherwise be very good for their health and probably help their pain problems a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that, so nerves can actually remember pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how does that actually work? How they remember the pain?
So they become, well, first I'd say it's convenient to talk about it in that way, but that's not really how it actually works, right?
Okay.
So I think it's important to recognize that pain is a cortical phenomenon, right? So that has to come from processing in the brain. Nociception comes from the peripheral nervous system, and that nociceptive signal is ultimately processed and becomes pain. So I think nociception can be remembered in the peripheral nerves through this process of sensitization, and you know that can involve changes in the expression of ion channels and things that regulate excitability. It can also be stored to some extent in the innervation patterns, like what I just talked about for low back pain. So there's many different kind of memory processes, I'd say, but they're quite different from memory, how you think about it in your brain. Sometimes people talk about pain being, you know, that there being a memory of, mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. pain in your cortex, and like that's being reactivated when you have chronic pain. And I don't think that's really what happens. I think what happens is that the nociceptive signal is there. It's very real. It just reorganized because of these changes that occur after the injury that don't readily go back to normal. So from my perspective, that gives a lot of hope for therapeutics, because it suggests that we can target these mechanisms in the periphery if we just understood them in most cases, and that could lead to a good chance for pain resolution.
Many people feel dismissed. They go to the doctor, they don't find anything specific, but they still have back pain, and they just say, you know, pain is in the brain.
I think that's totally wrong. I think the problem is that you can't image nerve endings. You know, the things that we're learning about now that change when people have these persistent joint-related pain disorders, we have no diagnostic tools to measure them. And we're not going to start routinely doing biopsies of people's discs. We shouldn't do that. But I think we should think about how to treat these things differently. And I think also there are a number of exciting new therapeutics that are going through either early stage or late stage clinical development now that have a good chance to change a lot of the way that we go about treating chronic pain, in particular for people with musculoskeletal disorders.
So pain is not in the brain?
Well, I mean, it definitely originates from the brain. There's no question about that. But my personal opinion is that the evidence for chronic pain having a peripheral origin is far stronger than the brain creating a pain experience out of nothing.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
My back surgery, I did actually have a lot of pain afterwards still. It was physical therapy. For me, it was mostly Pilates that really got me through it. And at the start, it was extremely painful, but it pretty quickly became pretty tolerable. And I'm completely convinced that at the end, it was the thing that got me to overcome everything. And now I mostly don't have low back issues. Every once in a while, you know, I will bend over and pick up one of my kids' toys and find myself unable to move for a day or two. But thankfully, it usually goes away. But I also know what I need to do for myself to be able to get back to being normal.
And also you need to practice that movement a little bit more frequently in order to get better at it, right?
Absolutely.
It's the law of specificity. You get good at things that you do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally true. I know for many people, it's stretching and things like that. Like, I'm the least flexible person on the planet. I'm pretty convinced.
You can learn
that. I've given up on that one. But, you know, for myself, I know what to do. So for me, it's like doing core exercises. They get me realigned or whatever it is, and I can overcome the pain that I have in my back, and it usually goes away in a day or two.
Good.
Ibuprofen helps me too. But, you know, I combine them. I never just do one.
Exactly.
You know, it's both.
Yeah. Perfect. So we actually touched base on how not sleeping enough or sleep can actually lower your pain threshold, mm-hmm. right? So how can things like anxiety or stress can make pain worse as well?
Yeah, that's absolutely the same thing. And I think the mechanisms are probably very similar. So we know that stress and anxiety can influence the immune system. I think one of the things in neurobiology that we've learned a ton about in the last 10 years is these neuroimmune interactions, and they go both ways. The immune system has a big effect on the brain. The brain also has a big effect on the immune system. So anxiety and stress can do that. But the other thing is, anxiety and stress have a big impact on these descending endogenous analgesic circuits. So turning on stress can turn what we normally refer to as descending inhibition into descending facilitation. And anxiety can do exactly the same thing. So I think they act in much the same way.
People with chronic pain, I think they already have anxiety, especially mm-hmm. with chronic low back pain, because they are scared to move. They have this fearful of movement, like what's going to happen if I turn the wrong way and I'm going to be in pain for days, you know, if pick up my kid's toy. What do you think they can actually do?
I think the best thing is to just understand the evidence. So I'm trained in pharmacology. I would love to say the evidence for efficacy is the best for some drug, okay? But I cannot tell you that with a straight face because it's not true. The studies that have been done demonstrate over and over again that exercise is the best thing for pain. There's just no, in my mind, there's no question about it. Every study that has looked at this has found essentially the same thing. If you can get to exercising, exercise has the best efficacy for chronic pain. So I think if people just understand that and know that, you know, it is definitely going to take some working through, and it's a really good idea to have somebody that can help you with it if you can get access to that kind of care. But nothing has better efficacy.
What happens in the brain when we exercise?
I mean, nobody knows exactly, again, but I keep going back to these descending circuits. So, I mean, it turns on the descending circuits. It has a profound effect on the immune system. So, you know, the way I kind of view it is it's a balance between these bad things that can happen with stress and anxiety and very positive things that go in the opposite direction that happen with exercise. You know, again, the evidence base is super clear. Exercise has the best efficacy for chronic pain.
Yeah. What kind of hormones are we releasing when we are exercising?
There are a couple different kinds. There are these hormones that come from the muscles themselves. Those are called myokines. And then there are other hormones that can come from the pituitary. Some of those are stress-related hormones. Some cytokines are released from the immune system during exercise. There's a variety of things that happen. Many of them are actually somewhat inflammatory, which is interesting. But they have, you know, very defined time courses that they don't last for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. They can when you first start to exercise, but, you know, over time they
subsides.
And there's some evidence that the myokines can be beneficial to the nervous system. We did a couple studies on that. We had trouble finding much that seemed to be changing along those lines, although I don't our work is definitive by any stretch of the imagination. I also think the immune stuff is probably extremely important. So I don't think you can pin it on any particular hormone, but exercise changes all kinds of hormones in pretty profound ways.
Are we releasing endorphins when we are exercising?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so that goes back to that endogenous brainstem center. I think they mostly act within the brain, mm-hmm. in the perioculocortical gray and the rostral ventral medial medulla. But yeah, no question about it. The exercise releases endorphins within the brain.
And is it good for us, endorphins?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain why?
Yeah, because it activates this endogenous pain inhibitory center in the brain. makes us feel better. It doesn't just inhibit pain that's coming from exercise. It inhibits pain from anything, really. So those endorphins are really quite powerful modulators of sensation.
Yeah, I feel great after exercising.
Me too.
Okay, so if someone wanted to start the process tomorrow to get better with chronic low back pain, what do you think the first step? Is it to understand their pain or understand their...
I think the first step should be to see a physician and make sure that there's not something really terribly wrong. Because, you know, I think for a lot of people, when they start having low back pain, there probably is something wrong. Mm. A sign that something could be seriously wrong is a motor impairment. So, you know, pain and also loss of strength in a limb, which is what I unfortunately had, you know, usually means you're going to need to have some kind of intervention. If it's mostly sensory, I think the evidence is probably better that you don't have an intervention, mm-hmm. at least not at first, because those can resolve. And they usually resolve when people do physical therapy. So I think getting into physical therapy and starting to do exercise to strengthen your low back, strengthen your core, can help most people tremendously. But I do think people should probably start by seeing a physician mm-hmm. to make sure...
To look at the red flags.
Exactly.
Did you have cauda equina syndrome, or was it...
I did not have cauda equina syndrome per se, but I definitely had an impingement within mm-hmm. the cauda equina.
Okay. Where do you think movement fits when it comes to calming the nervous system down? Or the pain system down?
I mean, the two systems interact in the spinal cord. Mm-hmm. You know, the motor system is basically sitting just on the other side of where the incoming sensory system is. And they're all kind of reflexes at that level that are extremely important for just your basic movement. So I think exercise can help to reset changes that can occur within the spinal cord that can cause reflexes to become hyperactive, things like that. So important from that perspective, no question. Movement, in terms of movement related to exercise, also is extremely important for all the brain centers and other things that we talked about before.
Do you exercise?
I exercise every day.
Every day?
This morning I did weightlifting because it's not my basketball day. And then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, sometimes Saturday, I play basketball.
So you mentioned that you hurt your back when you were doing deadlifting, right? Was it?
I think yeah. It was deadlifting, but I'm not exactly sure. But I will never do deadlifts again. Deadlifts are ruled out.
I actually hurt my back during squats, and I actually went back squatting, and yeah. I can do that with heavy weights. But there are days when I have to kind of like, okay, I have to take it easier, because I don't know, is it my body remembers the, and it's exactly the same spot I feel it, you know, on the left mm-hmm. side, and okay, and I just have to step back and let's just have a week off. Why is that? You know, I mean, I've been doing squats for 10 years now, and I had my injury 16 years ago or 15 years ago, and sometimes I still feel that.
When you hurt yourself squatting, you almost certainly had some kind of tissue injury at the time.
I had disc herniations.
There you go.
Yes.
So the disc herniation effect, in my view, would have affected your peripheral nervous system. You likely have some changes in innervation related to that injury that you had, and I hate to tell you, but it's never going to go back to the way it was before you had the injury. The disc is probably healed. You probably mm-hmm. don't have any active herniation anymore. But the changes that happen in the innervation of the area are probably mostly permanent. So the sensitization is still there to some extent too. And that is why you continue to, when you have pain, it continues to mostly be in the same place. It might spread to others, mm-hmm. but I bet it usually starts in that same place.
Usually the same place. And that's why I was asking if the body can remember the pain or, you know, yeah. because I feel like it's there. It's kind of like a memory.
Yeah. My experience is exactly the same. I mean, I had really severe pain in my low back on the left-hand side and then going down my left leg. And when it kicks on again, it's always the same spot. So sometimes it spreads to different areas, right? But when it starts, always same.
I have clients, they come to me because of their chronic low back pain, and we mm-hmm. start working with them, and after a couple of months, they feel better. But somehow their shoulder starts to hurt or mm-hmm. their knee. Why is that? Is it pain sensitization, or why do you think that is? And there is no injury.
I think, unfortunately, that's part of just getting older, actually. I don't know why it happens, but I think, first of all, musculoskeletal pain, which usually is joint-related, mm-hmm. is just something that occurs in almost everybody mm-hmm. throughout their life. I think staying active can definitely help people to deal with it. It's amazing. All these imaging studies that people will do longitudinally on folks, almost everybody develops osteoarthritis or something like that in some joint, right?
As we age, it's normal.
It is totally normal. But many people have these awful-looking joints, and they don't have pain. And then other people can have joints that don't look that bad. They're extraordinarily painful, and they need to have a replacement, right? So, again, my view on these differences is that it's related to how the nervous system changes mm-hmm. when you have those changes that can occur from relatively minor injuries or just from the normal aging process. And it could be that one of the reasons that people can have wicked-looking joints and not have pain is that they exercise a lot because mm-hmm. it's, you know, again, the evidence is that that's very protective. There are certain kinds of exercise that can make it so that you're more likely to have injuries, right? But yes. I mean, what we're talking about, I think, is just normal stuff. Any human being should be capable of doing if they practice. Don't have some other, if they practice and they don't have some other major reason that would stop them from being able to do it.
Yeah, it's very interesting you said that, because many people, research shows that people with scoliosis, they thought that scoliosis causes pain, but it doesn't. You know, it's probably the what it comes with, you know, the way you look, the way you hold your body, but scoliosis itself doesn't mm-hmm. cause the weird looking, you know, any angle or any different shape. They don't cause back pain or any kind of pain, mm-hmm. which is very interesting, because we thought scoliosis can cause pain, but it doesn't.
Very similar to... Yeah.
Exactly. So how do you explain to someone, because you mentioned that some level of pain is okay during exercising, same when you had your injury and you went back to Pilates and you did experience some pain. So if someone is going through the same, what's your advice?
Well, I don't see patients, so I don't tell many people this.
but as a neuroscientist...
Yeah, from a neurobiological perspective, I would say that, you know, it's... The nervous system becomes sensitized, and part of recovering from these kind of injuries and hopefully getting better is going to likely involve understanding what is an actual alarm bell and what is not, and kind of getting to learn your new body and limits. You know, after I had my surgery, my back injury, I definitely ended up with a new body. I have foot drop that has never gotten any better. I had to learn how to run again mm-hmm. because I can't lift my foot. I would just fall a lot. And, mm-hmm. you know, it took me a long time to get to that point. So, you know, I had to learn about my new motor abilities, but I also had to learn about my new sensory problems and figuring out, you know, what is good for me, what is not good for me. And I think everybody is, it's a little bit different for everybody. But I think if you think about it in that way, it's very helpful, because it can allow you to get past things that you might otherwise think, you know, oh, this is really a bad sign. There's something here that could really hurt me, when that may not really be the case. Again, I think working with a professional who knows this kind of stuff, be it a PT or physician, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, is very, very helpful, because, you know, they can help to educate you mm-hmm. about what's going on and to understand what's happened to you.
What I usually advise to my clients, that the pain that is tolerable is okay. And if the pain stops you, obviously we need to stop. Mm-hmm. But they know their body best. But if some level of pain is okay, because mm-hmm. you already have chronic low back pain, we start exercising, there is going to be some level of pain, right?
Yeah.
So you were the first to study how local protein synthesis in neurons is involved in chronic.
Right.
Can you explain that in a way that a 9-year-old could understand?
Yeah, I mean, so the idea behind what you just said relates to what we have talked about over and over again here. It's how does the peripheral nervous system mm-hmm. change after you have an injury. So the reason that we started studying this localized protein synthesis is because I thought the evidence was pretty strong that the changes in innervation of tissue after injury is at least partially responsible for why people develop chronic pain. And the nervous system is changing. It has to build stuff to be able to change. And this localized protein synthesis is probably an important part of that. I think we've shown that pretty conclusively over the last 2 decades of work that we've done in our lab. And now at 40 Therapeutics, which you mentioned at the beginning, we've developed a therapeutic that I think targets that and hopefully can either disrupt or prevent the innervation changes that happen, and also have a profound effect on the enhanced excitability that also occurs. I'm pretty hopeful that drug, which is about 3/4 of the way through phase 1 clinical trials right now and has so far shown a great safety profile, will turn out to be a really, really useful therapeutic for people with chronic pain.
So you've worked on new ways to treat pain without opioids. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important?
I think opioids are extraordinarily useful for acute severe pain. Evidence that they're useful for chronic pain is not great, although there is evidence supporting their use for chronic pain. I think people that have been using opioids stably for a long time probably shouldn't change what they do. But for people who are just developing chronic pain, should they be treated with an opioid? I would say definitely not. I think we have evidence that they can be harmful, aside from the other things that they do, and that there are other therapeutics that are likely to be better over the long term. And also, you know, focusing more on exercise and movement is probably a good idea. Opioids also have these terrible things that can happen with them. So they're very dangerous drugs if you take too much of them. They can cause overdose, and there is no question that they can be addicting. Do people that use them for pain often become addicted? I don't think we really know, but some certainly can become addicted. And I just think we have a great opportunity now to develop non-opioid therapeutics, given what we know about how the nervous system changes in people with chronic pain, that could be far more efficacious and have a fantastic safety profile.
I had a client last year, and she was on opioids, even though she had a lumbar fusion, didn't help her. And unfortunately, she's stuck in the cycle, and she was taking opioids for months. And she tried other things as well, but she said that was the only medication that helped her. Now she's off the opioids. She started exercising, and now she's, I think she's 6 months off opioids, but it was definitely a journey. But she just tried many things, but that was the only medication that could help her.
Yeah.
What does it do? I mean,
opioids act in the brainstem to activate this endogenous pain inhibitory system. And nobody has ever discovered any kind of drug that's more efficacious at doing that. And in fact, you know, they're literally mimicking the system that we all have in our brains to cause that endogenous analgesia. Whether that can be as powerful if you take the drug over a very long time is pretty questionable. But yeah, I hear the same story from physicians that I work with and the small number of people who have chronic pain problems that I talk to. There are many people that say that the opioids have worked fantastically well for them. Again, I think those people should probably stay on them if they're effective, unless there's some major reason to change.
They don't want to be on them because then they can't drive. They can't really...
That's definitely true, yeah.
And that is a problem. I remember she was saying that. And so anyway, that was the only medication that worked for her, unfortunately. So what are some of the most promising, safer options you see coming?
Well, there's a great example was approved by the FDA earlier this year, the NaV1.8 inhibitor, Dronavax. So that was developed by Vertex. So that's approved for acute pain, mostly for post-surgical pain, but there are phase 3 clinical trials ongoing for neuropathic pain right now. Unfortunately, there was a phase 2 trial for lumbar radiculopathy that was not successful. So we'll see ultimately what happens with that. But that drug, it targets this voltage-gated sodium channel called NaV1.8. It's very specifically found in the peripheral nervous system, really not any other tissue, almost exclusively in nociceptive neurons. So the safety profile of that drug is pretty remarkable. And I think there's a really good opportunity to test that in the real world to see if it can be effective for people with different types of chronic pain. And also probably because it's so safe to combine it with other therapeutics and look for what we call synergy between those drugs. And I think, you know, that could be a really exciting way to get good non-opioid analgesia.
Going back to opioids, also, it was very interesting, and I really wanted to ask this question from you. My client also said that her emotions changed when she was taking opioids. She didn't become emotional.
Yeah, opioids have effects on many other areas of the brain that have nothing to do with what they do for pain. So they're in the reward centers, obviously, because they can cause addiction. They're in your cortex, so they can affect attention and cognitive processes. And then also, you know, if you take them over a long period of time, they desensitize receptors, they cause tolerance, and they can have effects, you know, on all kinds of different types of processing in the brain. Those receptors are all over the place. They're also in respiratory centers, which is why they cause respiratory depression. And when people die of overdose, that is the reason people die, because they literally stop them from breathing.
That's very scary. Okay, so if someone's listening and they had pain for years and tried everything and feel absolutely heartbroken, what would you want them to know about pain?
I think the first thing is that there's a lot of good information out there now, and we're learning a ton about why people develop chronic pain. And I think understanding the mechanisms better can give people some level of hope, number one. Number two, these mechanistic insights that we're getting are leading to a lot of very exciting therapeutics entering clinical trials now. So I think there is a really good reason to have hope, because these new therapeutics could have really incredible efficacy. And they're not just the same drugs that people have been developing in the past. They are almost all non-opioids. They're targeting mechanisms that we haven't really developed drugs against previously. And they're really, in most cases, also based on really solid evidence from humans, you know, molecular evidence that we've gained by doing kind of studies that my lab and many other labs do. So I don't want to say it's an exciting time, because it's not exciting for that person, obviously. But I do think that there's a reason to have a lot of hope. And I feel like pain and some other neurological diseases right now are entering the kind of time that cancer was in 10, 15 years ago, where we had really started to understand how the immune system interacts with cancers. And that led to this development of these immunotherapies that have just absolutely transformed cancer care and survivorship, and also been less toxic than many of the chemotherapeutics that people would have been treated with. So I think that there's just a lot of reason to have hope that some real transformation is going to happen within the next couple of years.
Exciting.
I agree.
Not for people who are in pain, but looking at the future.
Yeah, well, sometimes hope is something that can also help you to find other things, like help you to get through the pain that you have when you're trying to get moving again, you know? So.
Exactly. And one more question. How is our mental health contribute to, you know, chronic pain? We were talking about stress, anxiety. Do you think that meditation or self-awareness can help with that as well?
Yeah, there's well, first of all, that there's we talked about depression before. I mean, that there's a very strong evidence base that chronic pain causes other issues, brain-related issues. Probably not neurodegeneration, which, you know, some there's been some concern about that given the human brain imaging studies, but I think those studies also demonstrate it's reversible. What was the other question?
The mental health and, you know, self-awareness.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the meditation.
Yes.
There's also a lot of evidence that that can be helpful.
Even cognitive behavioral therapy, I think it has a positive effect on...
Absolutely. The problem there is that the effect sizes are relatively small, right? So I think what you want to do is to take a holistic approach, right?
The whole person. Looking at the whole person and not just the back.
Exactly. Do things that are going to improve your overall feeling of mental health. Probably going to need to take some kind of therapeutics, and probably also going to need to do some kind of physical therapy or exercise related thing. And right now the evidence is that the exercise is going to probably improve you the most.
It's the base. They usually, clinical guidelines actually recommend multimodal treatment for people with chronic low back pain, addressing the sleep, physical activity, you know, mental health as well.
Totally.
All right. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for the listeners to tuning into the Back to Movement podcast. And this was all for this episode, folks. And we see you next time.